Dr. Campbell is a Jacob Gould Sherman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. He has received more than 70 grant years of peer-reviewed research, funding and authored more than 300 research papers. His legacy, the China Study, is the most comprehensive study of health and nutrition ever conducted. The study was the culmination of a 20-year partnership of Cornell University, Oxford University, and the Chinese Academy of Preventative Medicine. Dr. Campbell, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm very happy to have you here. I absolutely loved your book.
Well, thank you. It was
just so informative and full of such wonderful information because we do get such conflicting messages. And, you know, I mean, being the host and producer and creator of this health show, I have a lot of different authors on, oh, you should eat this and don't eat that and don't eat too much fruit. And my philosophy is I call myself a whole foodatarian, which if it's a whole food, I'm eating it. And I'm sure you can speak to that as well.
Right.
You know, the benefits of that. Now, you know, I'd like to start with a lovely description from your book, you know, quote, on a golden morning in 1946, when summer was all tuckered out and fall wanted to be let in, all you could hear on my family's dairy farm was quiet. I thought that was so beautiful and gave such a description of the way that you grew up. If you can tell us about your childhood on the farm and how that affected your later research.
Yeah, well, I'm a farm boy through and through, I guess I can say. it was a great life. I loved it. It was hard work. It was 365 days a year of work. But, you know, I, growing up under those circumstances, you look back and it was really nice. And I was the first one in my family, on either side of my family, to even go to college, let alone go to graduate school. So, you know, getting into the business of research and science and policy and all that kind of thing that I did, it was moving to a new universe for me.
Yeah, and weren't you originally going to see how you can better use the cattle? And I mean, wasn't it more about making meat more efficient, and then it turned into something completely different?
Yes, in my graduate studies at Cornell University for my PhD, we have to do research, of course, and my research project for my doctorate was basically an attempt to try to figure out ways to produce animal-based protein more efficiently.
Okay.
Than had been the case. And so I was very much into the idea of the good old American diet being the best there was, and eating, you know, all meat, milk, and eggs until it came out of our ears. I mean, I thought that's what it was all about. But then as I went through my career, basically all funded by the National Institutes of Health, and with lots of students and colleagues, I just come to learn something very, very different. And had to face the music, had to look at the data.
Yeah, and how was that for you? That must have been so hard based on the way that you grew up to have to make that paradigm shift in the way you were taught and what you believed.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, I suppose if I'm just thinking about myself in this case, but I have to say, too, that while all this is going on, I'm just becoming aware of the number of people who are sick in the country and dying prematurely. Who, you know, if they had known this information, that wouldn't have had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, from my point of view, all I need to go to is the closest, senior center, and see some folks in there who are suffering near the end of their life, and needlessly, I should say, in many cases.
Yeah, you know, you talk about in your book as well that you had some people in your life. I know your father, he had heart disease, and I know you spoke about an aunt who was dying of cancer, and I'm sure seeing these had such an impact on you and your work.
Yes, I mean, we all do. We all have family,
of course.
You know, that suffer this kind of thing. But being in science and seeing that there is another way to think about this, and just a way, in fact, that would have, you know, prevented them from having that kind of experience. I mean, gosh, this decision becomes easy.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, even though you did get some resistance from your other scientists, even with the scientific evidence, it was hard for them to change the way they were thinking. Is that correct?
Yes, and it still is. I mean, I am making my argument, if you will, or making my presentation of the information, my view known, based on the basic science and, you know, what does nutrition really do? Compared, let's say, to genes, or what does nutrition really do compared to nutrient supplements, or, you know, you start looking at it from the very basic scientific point of view, and that's what I've, you know, spent my career doing, and I just find that the information as to what nutrition can do, and that's generally not known, that what nutrition can do is just amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and if you, oh, I'm sorry, go on.
We can cure heart. I say we use that a little bit liberally, but we can cure heart disease. My good friend, a surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic, does that. You know, people with advanced heart disease who have been given up, you know, there's nothing more they can do. He can turn them around and cure them of their disease. He did that. And in my work, you know, in the case of cancer, my specialty was cancer, I was learning experimentally we could turn on and turn off cancer development by nutritional means. I mean, that's pretty spectacular.
It is spectacular. And it obviously isn't getting enough attention.
No, it's not getting really any attention because what I'm talking about, of course, confronts the way we practice medicine. It confronts the way, you know, the industries, the food and drug industries, for example. It confronts those industries as to what they're doing. And so it's difficult to get the message across, but on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's a good message. And so I'm going to keep at it until the day I leave this earth. But I spent 20 years also in policy development, you know, on expert panels in Washington and London and other places like that. And so I had an opportunity to see, you know, how science interfaces with, let's say, the real world of politics and policy.
Mm.
And so that kind of experience, too, enabled me to see why it is that the public has not heard this message before.
Yeah,
and that's what it comes down to.
So it really comes down to money and politics.
It comes down to money.
That is so sad. I mean, here we have ways that we can help people and live a healthier life, and it's just the politics are ridiculous. Now, I wanted to ask specifically about the China project, and that was done, I mentioned from the introduction, with Oxford and Cornell, and also, obviously, you worked with people in China. Now, how did this come about? Was this your idea, and then you approached these other institutions and people?
Well, in the early 1980s, when the United States and China were first starting to talk to each other again, the first senior scientist from China who came to the United States came to my laboratory at Cornell University, a certain Dr. Chen Zhengshu, and I was excited about having him, you know, with our, in our group a bit. And when he was present, when he was there, we learned about his government having just released information on how much cancer existed, you know, in different counties around China, in about 2,400 counties. And so we said, why don't we go there? And what we learned was that cancer was very common in some places and much less common in other places. But why don't we get together and do a study and try to figure out, you know, why is cancer so concentrated geographically like that? And so we organized the study, and it was funded, actually, by the National Institutes of Health. And this was the first project between the United States and China, first research project. And then the Chinese government, they made available an enormous amount of professional labor at no cost. And, of course, Oxford University at the same time, where I spent a year as well, contributed in a major way. So we got something going and ended up, you know, doing this project that then became known as the most comprehensive, you know, study on diet and disease ever conducted.
Now, what was the dark secret you discovered about children and protein over in China while doing this project?
I'm sorry, the question was on protein in children?
Yes, and in China. You mentioned in the book, you say there's a dark secret that you discovered about the connection between children and protein consumption. And what was that?
Yeah, well, we've lived with this here myth, quite frankly, you know, for our children especially, that the more protein they get, the faster they grow. And it's generally true. If we consume foods that are high in protein, especially high-quality protein like animal foods, milk, meat, and eggs, and stuff like that, you know, our kids will tend to grow a little bit faster, but it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost. Because when they grow so fast like that, you know, they reach their reproductive age earlier. And this can be, especially, you can see this in girls especially. And they, so they reach puberty earlier. Then they're in the reproductive period earlier. And for a woman, if she continues on that same diet for the rest of their lives, they reach menopause later. So their total sort of reproductive years is about 9 years longer on average for the United States and Western countries than it is for China.
Uh-huh.
And so during those extra 9 years, they also are exposed to a much higher concentration of estrogen. Now, all of that sort of feeds into that and other factors, feeds into a higher risk for breast cancer in the case of women, and probably a higher risk for prostate cancer in the case of men, although it's not estrogen, in that case it's other hormones. But in any case, growing children as fast as we possibly can by giving as much protein as possible, which is sort of the mantra of the day, it's really not good. I mean, we can raise children on, let's say, plant-based diets, which has the optimum level of protein, the right kind of protein, and more importantly, has all the other nutrients in good balance as well. If we do it that way, then a lot of things just sort of fall into place.
Now, why is it that people aren't aware that there, you know, is protein in a plant-based diet? Because whenever I talk to anyone about, you know, if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, they're like, well, where do you get the protein? And, oh, you got to mix the right amount of beans and the right amount of corn or the right amount of brown rice, and you have to be so careful. But it sounds like from what you're saying is there is protein in a plant-based diet.
That's a very sad myth. It has an interesting history, by the way. Most people tend to think of protein as being meat. It's almost like synonymous. It started out that way 150 years ago or more when protein was first discovered. I mean, when you mention protein, they think of meat, or possibly meat or milk or eggs or something like that. They're not aware, as you just said, that plants have plenty of protein. And you don't need to worry about mixing and matching things like that. If one assumes, you know, basically a variety of whole plant-based foods, that's a variety of vegetables and whole grains and legumes and fruits and things like that, we get all the protein we need. And nature will do all the balancing it needs to do. We can forget it. So the balancing idea is crazy. We don't need to worry about, you know, how much protein we're getting as long as we're eating, you know, good wholesome food.
Yeah.
And that's just perfect for, you know, maintaining health and preventing disease.
Yeah, I mean, it completely makes sense. And, I mean, I mentioned in the introduction as well about the Atkins and the South Beach. And there's so many diets where they want you to restrict your carbs and take out fruit. And that just this doesn't make sense to me because, again, like I said in the beginning, I'm a whole foodarian. I had a yam for breakfast, okay?
That's plain yam
with nothing on it. And it was delicious and it filled me up. And, again, I, you know, people always assume that, you know, oh, you must never eat anything you're not supposed to, or you must be perfect. It's like, no, but I really do try overall to not eat anything processed, you know. And the other
question,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's what you just said. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I talk about, you know, the distinction between, let's say, animal-based foods and plant-based foods a lot. But I also want to say that the emphasis should really be on whole plant-based foods. And unfortunately, we sometimes take things out of those plants, like sugar or white flour or oil. We mix it up in a bowl and we get a donut or a Danish. So we end up with these processed foods. And so, you know, processed foods are really not good.
No, they're not.
And processed foods and animal-based foods, and we should really focus on the whole plant-based diet. You know, that's the really health message.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, it's hard with so many people wanting to lose weight. And I used to be a, you know, health and lifestyle coach, and they would ask me about calories. And I heard you I saw you on a YouTube giving a presentation, and you talked about I never talked about calories. I would just say eat whole foods. And I think they thought, well, but how come you're not restricting this or taking that? It's like, just eat your whole foods, eat your whole grains, I'll teach you how to make them, you know. And it just seemed puzzling because here they're told they're supposed to just be living on hamburgers without the buns and thinking that's healthy.
Yeah, we become fixated. We, you know, as a society, I think the human brain works that way, but we tend to fixate on specific numbers and specifically identified foods and things like that. We really get caught up in all this specificity,
mm-hmm.
and we miss the idea of the wholesomeness of, you know, whole food.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
I forget who was the author. It was called The Tyranny of Counting. I love that book.
I haven't heard of that.
But it basically was pointing out that, you know, we do get caught up in numbers and, you know, and just spend all of our time thinking about, you know, if we tweak it this way, that way, and so forth and so on, we're going to get a big health benefit. And all the while, we're really forgetting about, you know, which kind of whole food should we be consuming.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. So obviously, you know, the message from the book, you know, people are like, okay, what should I eat? It's, you know, plant-based, whole foods, grains are okay, whole grains, brown rice, millet, quinoa. What about even whole grain, you know, whole wheat pasta? A lot of people are saying you shouldn't eat wheat. You should go gluten-free, and obviously some people do have celiac disease and other issues. But if you don't, do you have any opinions about whole wheat?
Well, whole grains are fine, and unless, of course, mm-hmm. you know, people know that they have some allergies, and people do. I mean,
yes.
gluten allergies are reasonably common, not really common, but, you know, there are people who, if they become aware of that, yes, avoid the gluten-containing foods. There's no question about that. And, you know, use some other kind of whole grains, if you will.
Yeah. No.
So that's...
Oh, I'm sorry. What's your opinion about, and I apologize for interrupting, for about raw foods? Because, you know, I had to cook my yam. I mean, I'm not going to eat a raw yam, you know, but there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, well, if you really want to get the most health, then you have to eat everything raw.
Well, yeah, I've got some colleagues in that community, and I've spoken at those institutions that get great results by using raw food. There's no question about that. Really for marvelous results when they raw plant-based food, I should point out. but in any case, I'm not sure that going 100% raw provides maximum health compared to, let's say, being 70% raw or 60 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we should be using food, you know, as much as possible in the native state. That's, you know, lots of salads and fruits and things like that. That's all raw.
Mm-hmm.
So if we and also then the food that we do cook, and I like cooking much myself.
Me too.
I mean, you know, not overcooking things. That's key. But, you know, cooking things lightly. So just not, you know, using heat excessively to destroy things, but in the process. But I think, you know, the 100% raw thing is hard for a lot of people. And I'm not sure that that's the best in all circumstances in any case.
Yeah, that is tough, especially you live in, you know, I live, you know, near Boston. It's cold. I mean, it gets cold here, and I could, you know, in the summer, I love doing a lot of raw foods, and I do them throughout the year, but I like a hearty vegetable stew or, you know, something you know, to warm you up. So that's nice. Now,
absolutely.
There was something in your book I wanted to touch on, because when you talked about how, you know, the society or the media will grab on to something about cancer, but here you have all this great information and they're not wanting to see it because of politics and money. And you talked about the hot dog missile, and it made me laugh because when I was a kid, my mom wouldn't buy hot dogs because of the sodium nitrates. And I grew up with that just all the time. You can't have a hot dog, sodium nitrate. And that got so much attention. And here there's other things that you're talking about that aren't getting the attention. If you could address that.
Yeah, that comes back to the point I was making before about, you know, getting too detailed about information. The nitrite story, by the way, I'm sure that being in New England, you would have probably heard more than elsewhere, but it was a national story because that nitrite study actually was done at MIT, where I spent 2.5 years myself. But in any case, you know, people do get caught up. We all get caught up in worrying about the tiny, tiny bits of something that has been found to be not helpful or, you know, unhealthy, and instead of thinking about the whole food again, and the little bit of nitrite that may have been present in the hot dogs at that time, and incidentally, it was much less than it had been in prior years when we used to salt, you know, brine meats, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of nitrite that's been, it was, I'm absolutely convinced, it was totally harmless, you know, at that particular point in time. It was information that was really taken out of context because of all this interest in just focusing on, you know, the cancer-producing ability of nitrite, to be specific. You know, but that the ability of nitrite to cause that kind of problem was associated with far, far higher levels than we would ever be exposed to.
I
don't want to dismiss, you know, the presence of a few nasty chemicals in food here and there. I don't want to dismiss that at all. We need to, you know, bring that under control and absolutely minimize it when we can. But, you know, we can't at the same time focus on that as the only cause, let's say, of all of our health problems. Because when we do that, then we're going to be missing this other message about, you know, whole plant-based foods, which is far more important.
Yeah. Now, speaking of whole plant-based foods, do you I'm assuming that you recommend organic when possible?
Yes. I do, because many people know that growing plants in good soil and without fertilizers, if possible, certainly without pesticides and herbicides and things like that, you know, you're getting a more wholesome food, and you're getting food that's free of those kind of things. And we don't know exactly how harmful they can be, and they could be quite harmful in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good idea to go that route as much as we can. You know, supporting local farm markets, farm-to-market sort of ideas, or growing gardens and things like that, you know, and growing good soil. I mean, those are all important things. They're important things.
Yeah,
that's what we used to do when I was being raised on a farm. We didn't have pesticides and herbicides, but they hadn't even invented them at that time. And so I guess we and the word organic hadn't been yet invented. That's what it was. But that's the way we ate, nonetheless. We were eating, you know, the food from the soil, even from the native soil.
Yeah, they say now the soil is really depleted.
That's right. That's another issue that has been, you know, not discussed enough over the years. We've lost a lot of our soil, our topsoil in the United States. You know, it's gone and eventually gets into the rivers, goes down the rivers, down the Mississippi River, builds a delta the size of the state of Rhode Island, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico. And so we've lost a lot of topsoil. It's a big issue. It's a really big issue because topsoil takes, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to, you know, to get to the state that, you know, it's good and healthy. And that's a bad deal.
Yeah, it is. No, I'd love to have you come back and talk about that sometime. I'm just recently learning about these things. You know, I didn't realize that, but I do know that obviously that it's good to eat organic foods when possible. And you mentioned in the beginning, you were talking about reversing heart disease and cancer, or at least not reversing cancer, but turning off the switch. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yes, I do mean reversing cancer.
Oh, you do? Okay. Oh, good. I'm glad that I brought that up.
Experimentally, that's what we were doing. We could turn on and turn off cancer even after it was already present. As tumors start to shrink, I mean, I really am talking about turning it off. Unfortunately, in the case, these were experimental studies with experimental animals in this particular case, but we also had some evidence in humans, too, that, you know, this kind of thing seems to occur when people eat the right way. I've given a lot of lectures around the country since the book came out almost 5 years ago now. Probably lectures, about 300 lectures, I think, and a lot of them in the medical institutions, the medical schools, and I meet patients, I meet doctors and others, and I keep getting just one report after another, all anecdotal. I know this is true, but, I mean, so many people who say, you know, I had cancer, I went this, and all of a sudden all my cancer symptoms went away. You know, and I hear that, and as a scientist, I say, wait a minute, that's anecdotal, that's a case of one, that's a case. Well, you know, I have to sort of say that on the one hand. But on the other hand, from the physiological, biochemical, sort of basic science point of view, it's possible because we demonstrated it. And so I really think that this could be a huge story for the future. That, you know, whereas we can cure people of advanced heart disease, I'm going to suggest that if we do it the right way, that there's a lot of evidence to support the idea we can actually reverse cancer as well.
Wow. Well, you know, I just interviewed Suzanne Summers recently. I don't know if you're familiar with her new book, Knockout, and it's about doctors that are curing cancer. And it's all these, you know, doctors that are off the mainstream and they're doing amazing things. They have incredible stories about folks with, you know, stage 4 pancreatic cancer that are, you know, 17 years and they're still around. And they do a lot of nutritional therapies and a lot of food-based therapies. And it was fascinating. So it really opened my eyes to this.
Yes, there are a lot of those kind of claims, and that's, of course, what I was just referring to, because, I mean, I hear a lot of this kind of thing going on. I'm being from the laboratory, from the scientific point of view, and I'm saying that, you know, well, that's what we all discovered in the laboratory. You know, so the two go hand in hand. When you see the science sort of supporting that idea, and then you turn around and you sort of start to realize that, gosh, there's a lot of people around actually doing this with real humans, with real problems. You know, it's a very powerful story that's emerging here. It really is.
It really is. Now, for people who are listening, if they're eating a mainly processed diet, do you have any advice just to help them? What are simple things they can do? Because it's kind of overwhelming to make a lot of changes at once. Just simple things they can do that they can start substituting to kind of move on the road to going to a whole food diet, plant-based diet?
First thing I would say, and this is probably the last thing I would have said years ago, but the first thing that people should do is quit using dairy products.
Yep, I totally agree.
That's number one. You know, kids don't need to go up drinking a glass of milk a day or two or three or whatever. I mean, that's a very political kind of thing that arose in, over the years. But that's number one. I mean, there's a lot of milk allergies alone, you know, a cause of a lot of problems, you know, in the short run. But and milk, by the way, and dairy is an animal-based food, so, you know, it's not the way to go. The second thing is that, you know, in cooking food, use the whole plant-based food. Get a cookbook. There's a lot of them out now to show, you know, how menus can be put together and recipes and things using, mixing and matching different kinds of plant-based foods. And create a dinner like that. Don't add back a lot of salt, sugar, and fat. But what I mean by that is don't use fried foods.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of, in a sense, adding, you know, cooking things, floating things in oil to cook them. That's not a good idea.
No.
add a lot of salt, and don't add a lot of sugar in baking. So I think that's the main message. And also using, you know, fresh foods, of course, organic foods. You know, don't overcook things, you know, and just get a cookbook and start just playing around with it if one's interested in our cooking. In the kitchen, there's various and sundry things that can be done. There's some really nice books coming out on they're usually referred to as vegan sort of recipes, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use the V words, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I try to avoid that because, you know, 90% of the vegetarians, I didn't get into this business because I wanted to promote vegetarianism or veganism, that was for sure. But 90% of the vegetarians are still consuming dairy and eggs and sometimes a little fish now and again.
Yeah.
Their diet, nutritionally speaking, is not that different from the non-vegetarian. So they're not going to see a lot of gain. They might see a little gain here and there. The vegans, in turn, you know, are avoiding all animal-based foods. And so they're presumably having, you know, they're not consuming the dairy, for example. So they have a leg up on the vegetarians. But the problem with the vegans is because they became vegans for ideological reasons, they didn't think too much about health. And as a result, vegans use a lot of processed foods.
Oh,
and
I
so,
see.
You know, as a, then in turn, they're not consuming the whole plant-based foods. And so they're not gaining as much as they could either. So I don't use, you know, I don't like to define my information in terms of, you know, promoting veganism or vegetarianism. It's just, it's basically whole plant-based foods.
Yeah, I still like my term, the whole foodarian. I don't know, I think we should coin that,
I
you know?
You've introduced a new one to me. I mean, that sounds pretty good.
Okay, well, if you use it in a talk, I'm just saying, Lisa Davis said.
Right.
Well, you know, I would love to have you back. The time goes by way too quickly, and I just want to let everyone know they've been listening to Thinking Out Loud. It's Your Health on WUML 91.5 FM, and we've had the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Campbell. And how can people find out more about you, Doctor?
Oh, they can find out some nasty things that people put on there because
oh, no.
They don't like my ideas. But,
well, I like your ideas.
we have a website I would suggest. But it's built by a foundation in my name. I didn't care for that, but that's the way it worked out. It's www.tcolincampbell.org.
Okay.
And that website, I've got some wonderful young people working with me on that. We have a course on there. Teaching plant-based nutrition. It actually came from a course that I was teaching at Cornell for some years in the classroom. And we're now working with the Cornell University-owned online company. And we've got this fantastic course. As I say, it's for plant-based nutrition. If you go to that site, www.tcolincampbell.org, and then see what's on there. We've got a lot of articles and of course, the course that people can do is taken off like a shot.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, I want to thank you so much again, and I'd love to have you come back in the near future. If you want to reach me, it's yourhealthradio.org. Keep listening. Coming up next is CJ Lyons, author of Lifelines, Warning Signs, and her latest, Urgent Care. So keep listening.